We made this.
Welcome to the XCast, The Truth is in Here. I'm your host, Annie Flowers, and today my guest is Dina Ferrari. Hello, Dina, how are you?
Hi, Annie. I'm good. I've been listening to Moby all afternoon to set the mood.
Oh. Do you still have the CD, or are you streaming now?
I don't remember if I had the CD or not, okay. But I streamed it.
Okay, I did have the CD, and I remember listening to it a lot in my car.
Yeah.
All right. Today's episode is All Things. It originally aired on April 9th, 2000. This is the 17th episode of the 7th season, written and directed by Gillian Anderson. And this is the only writing and directing credit to her name. So that's kind of interesting. I should say the only thing that she's written and directed for X-Files, to be clear. Now, the episode summary says, Scully is finishing up the autopsy of a person at a hospital. A file mix-up involving the autopsy folder and another patient's x-ray leads Scully to discover a former lover of hers has been admitted at the hospital. Meeting with him again causes Scully to re-examine the decisions she has made in her life, leading her to where she is today. But really, it should say that this is where we find out that Mulder and Scully are romantically involved. That's really...
Yeah,
the gist of it.
It's interesting that that was not her original plan when she wrote this. And I mean I've watched this episode many times, but I only watched the commentary for the first time last week. And I did not know that.
I learned a lot from the commentary last week. It was very interesting. I did know that Frank Spotnitz and the team had approached her after she had already written the script and asked her to go ahead and add that in, that they thought it was time for Mulder and Scully to become romantically involved. But there are darker aspects of the script that didn't actually make it into the final cut that I thought were really interesting. So I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more. Now, what do you think of this episode? How would you rate it?
So... I really like it. I have I think it is underappreciated. I think that we get so little of Scully's inner life, so little of her emotions. We just sort of see Gillian do like sort of facial expressions and like the tone of her voice. Mulder and Scully never really have direct conversations about feelings.
No.
And so I like that Gillian took the chance to like give us a little of like her own insight into Scully, but she also sort of like built on some things, like some seeds that were planted in earlier episodes, like from Lazarus. And maybe, I mean, I really think that she relates to Colleen a little bit because she reminds Scully of Melissa. And so like that's sort of in there. It's like sort of under the surface. And I also like that it ends, like it's another story. Like Never Again was a story about Scully examining her choices. It's a story about Scully examining her choices, but it ends with her being confident in the choices that she made and feeling like with Mulder working on the X-Files is like where she wants to be, where she is supposed to be. And I really loved it when it first aired. I was in college. I was like 20 years old and I just like loved it. I was like really into it. And I sort of like, I mellowed a little bit, but I still really like it. It's like a couple things that I sort of bristle at science-wise and like a couple things that maybe like don't work. But like to me, like the episode's really about Scully's emotional journey. And like I think that part is done really, really well.
Yeah, I agree. Season 7 in general is a little strange, I think. And this kind of fits in with the strangeness. It doesn't quite have the same look or feel as any other episode. But then, you know, you think, well, if Gillian had maybe written or directed more, maybe she would have her own body of work on The X-Files, and you can follow that arc the way you can follow, you know, watch like all of the Darren Morgan episodes and all of the Morgan Wong episodes. And so I think it's interesting in that way, but I really like the mood that it sets. It's very like calming. It's you can kind of have it on in the background and it's not jarring. So for example, like during Halloween time, I like to put on Shapes, and I know it's a controversial episode and may not be the most culturally sensitive, but I do like the atmosphere of the episode. And so it's kind of just a good episode to have on while I'm doing whatever around the house. And I kind of feel that way about All Things, where it's one of those episodes where I could just have it on and Moby's playing and it just sets a general mood. It doesn't make you it's not terribly depressing. It's not terribly anything. It's, I guess, a real good mood setter. I've said mood a lot, so.
Yeah, well, it's like, it definitely gets pretty emotional, but it ends, like, in an uplifting
way.
So it's like the you know, maybe there's a little bit of a roller coaster, but you feel good but at the end. But not with
maybe jump scares or, you know, right. It has kind of an even tone, and you have the music that, like, the dinging sound and everything kind of has this like heart, the entire episode has this heartbeat to it. So I do like it. It's not my favorite, but I think it's really distinct, I guess. And that makes it really cool, I think. Like a really great first effort by Gillian Anderson. So
yeah. And like when you think about it, you know, she's been playing this character for 6 years and change. So, like, she definitely has some ideas in her head about what's going on in Scully's head.
Right.
And as, like, a lot of other people pointed out, the way, like, Morgan and Wong write Scully is different from the way that, you know, Vince Gilligan writes Scully is different from Chris Carter writing Scully. Like, that sort of thing. So, like, Gillian has her own Scully.
And I like her very internal Scully. It's she's very thoughtful and attempting to kind of find her path in life. And I know that part of that has to do with where she is in terms of her life on The X-Files. But you might not have had that kind of episode had it been written by anyone else. And it feels very personal. And I know Gillian Anderson obviously put a lot of herself into it with her own spiritualism.
Yeah. And I think, like, to go off your point about season 7, I think it really fits into the mood of season 7 as far as, like, where Mulder and Scully's relationship is, like, not just, like, are they romantically involved or not, like, but they sort of, like, in season 7, their relationship sort of, like, I feel like it calms down. Like, you feel like you can step back and take a breath. There's not quite so much conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to sort of be, like, in a place of, like, acceptance as to, like, whatever the relationship is, what it is there. It's not exactly, you know, Mulder's, like, they're working all the time. It's not Scully's, you know, get out of the damn car and live a normal life. It's, like,
right.
Somewhere in between, but they're both sort of okay with it. And you actually see them, like, hanging out together, which is, like, it's sort of nice after, like, all, like, you know, years of crisis and trauma and tragedy.
Right.
Like, over and over and over. It's, like, season 7, I feel like, is, like, a little bit of a break, you know, before Requiem. And then there's,
yeah.
You know, a lot more trauma and 15 episodes of Scully in despair. So, yeah, I feel like it's a nice break.
So it seems like we both like the episode. What would you rate it?
I'd probably give it, like, 7 out of 10. I was going back and forth between a 7 and 7.5. I think I'm landing on a 7.
Okay, great. I'm at about a 7.5.
Okay, cool.
Partially, and I know Sarah Blair talks a lot about this, but because of the rewatchability of it, you can just have it on and it feels good. So let's dig into the episode then. We open on Scully getting dressed in the bedroom. There's a monologue. Some people really hate the monologuing, not of this episode specifically, but in general on the show. What do you think of this particular monologue?
Oh, I like this one.
Okay.
Yeah, like, I'm also like, I don't, the monologues don't bother me, I think, as much as they bother other people, for the most part. I mean, the ones in My Struggle 3, like, that was a little much for me over the driving.
Yes.
But I like the, but I really, I'm into this idea of like forks in the road and which path do you choose and like, what does it mean for the entire future of your life? And like, that's a theme that's been explored in like some other episodes in different ways. It's just something that like, I find interesting to think about. So I like it. And oh, and also this is like a side note. Is this the first time we see the green sweater?
I believe so, but I'm not an expert on wardrobe, so I'm okay. Not going to.
I've always really liked the green sweater, but it's like you can't miss it because it's like so bright green.
Especially when contrasted with her red hair.
Yeah. So like I've watched a bunch of season 7 leading up to this, but I did skip a few because I just like ran out of time and I was wondering. But anyway, so do you have any feelings on the monologue?
Yeah, I mean, I really like it. I hope this isn't boring because we both agree on the same thing. I'm about to ask a controversial question soon, so hopefully that'll mix things up.
I like divisive episodes. The last one I was on was Never Again, so.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah. Yeah. I really like it. I think it's introspective and it's how we all feel. It's not one of those monologues that feels almost aloof, and it actually feels important to your life. It's something that I can personally relate to. Yeah, no, this is a really relatable one, and I really like it. Although I tend to not be too bothered by the monologues. It's kind of, that's what X-Files is.
Yeah.
So I'm used to it because I grew up and that's just what it is to me. And X-Files is never going to be any different. Although I will agree with you on some of the revival ones that this is not a revival.
No, it's like episode. Yeah, we won't, you know, go down that road or take that fork in the road.
No, not our fork. Not yet anyway. But yeah, so I like that. To elaborate a little bit more, we see Scully getting dressed in Mulder's bathroom. There's rain outside the window, and as Scully leaves, we kind of like go up Mulder's naked leg. He's covered. Oh, at first we don't know that it's Mulder, I guess. Do we recognize that as his bathroom? I mean,
have we ever? Isn't there a whole thing? It's like we've never seen his bathroom. Is this the? This might be the only time we've seen his bathroom. Like, wasn't there a whole joke about his bathroom is at Scully's house? Because, like, you never see the bathroom.
Huh. I don't know.
So I don't think I recognized it as Mulder's bathroom at first. But, I mean, the first time I saw it was so long ago. And the other thing that I thought of that I never thought of before was, like, you know, Mulder had the waterbed. And then after Monday, like, what did, like, the waterbed sprung a leak. But, like, did that sort of, like, revert? Did he get a new bed? Does he still have the waterbed? This is not important, but it was something I was wondering.
I think he got a new one.
Because it didn't really look like a waterbed. I feel like you would have seen like some motion. So I guess he got a new bed, which is nice because, you know, you can't sleep on the couch forever.
My headcanon is he got rid of the waterbed, personally. Now, here's my very controversial question that could start a whole Twitter war.
Whoa.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going there. Do you believe that this was their first time? Or are you part of the Season of Secret Sex?
I was never a Season of Secret Sex person. This was the first time I thought that they slept together. But like, you know, like in the sequence of watching it, I think so. I don't have like a really strong opinion, but like this, in my head, it makes sense that it would be. Although also in my headcanon, another time, whether it was, you know, the only time or how many times there were, like another time would have been like at the end of Hollywood AD when Scully's got Skinner's credit card and like, you know, they sort of walk off giggling. Like it warms my heart to think like that would have been one of the times. And this is coming from someone who is not a shipper, but you know, it is what it is. It's like, we know it happened. So
interesting.
I feel like I'm sort of like in the spectrum from like shipper to Norma. I'm like right in the middle.
Okay. So you don't mind it, but you're not, it's not the reason why you watch the way it is for some people.
I sort of like, I didn't want the show to change. I didn't want it to become a sitcom. I don't want like, you know, I don't want to watch Sam and Diane or Ross and Rachel, you know, like I wanted the X-Files to be, you know, as it was with Mulder and Scully as they were. I didn't want it to like ruin the show. That was my thing. Or like it to be like too much about it.
Yes. I understand, but I'm a shipper and I'm with you. I don't want a sitcom. I don't want the tension between them to be a romantic tiff that they have. I don't want that to be the show. I want them to just like do their thing, be Mulder and Scully. But for me, the show works really well when they work well together. That's not to say they can't have outside tension. Anyway,
yeah,
not necessarily an MSR episode, but yeah. Right. So that's where I'm coming from. And I do subscribe to the idea of the season of secret sex. And I have a reason that is in this episode that's why I think that it is. And we'll talk about that when we get there.
Okay. But on that topic, not to spend too much time on it. Sure. Like, did you think that during season 7, while it was on, or like, was this something that people thought then, or was it after season 8, knowing, you know, what we know in season 8 that, you know what I mean? I always wondered that.
It was so long ago that I don't remember. I think it's, for me personally, looking back.
Yeah.
I think I saw this episode and I was like, what? Did they just... I was watching with my best friend. I would go over to her house on Sunday nights and watch it with her, or she'd come over to mine. And I didn't quite believe it. And I think it took me a long time to accept that Chris Carter would give us that.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so I was never quite sure. But looking back, that's when I was like, oh, it started earlier. I mean, look at how flirty they are in Goldberg Variation or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I feel like I can see more of the, like, the flirting. And I'm also sort of interpreting that as just them being, like, you know, having a break from some of the drama and, like, the mood is just sort of lighter. Yeah, I could really only see it in hindsight.
Yes. We have a lot to say on this teaser that really nothing has happened. Scully like got dressed and walked out the door and it was raining outside and that's about it. Mulder was sleeping.
Yes.
We have a lot to say on this.
Possibly in a waterbed, possibly in a regular bed.
Possibly not. We don't know. Everyone, please let us know. Does he still have his waterbed? What do you think? Do you have proof from Monday that he either does or does not have his waterbed?
Yes. And please keep listening because we are going to move on.
Right now.
Yes.
So we have the credits and then we open on this bright light, which we soon realize is a projector. And there is this rare modern music playing. You don't really get a lot of like modern music on the X-Files. I think I can think of like, you know, they played Garbage, all the music that they played in like DPO Closure,
yeah, that's what had I was Moby. Thinking of.
Yeah. So whenever you do have modern music, it's very, you know, it perks me up. I'm like,
yeah, you notice.
This is interesting. It gets your attention. How do you like Moby? You used to listen to Moby?
Yeah. I mean, I like just sort of in general, like it's some, like I would certainly put Moby on every now and then on Spotify, but like I was not like a Moby super fan or anything, but like I really enjoy Moby. I definitely recognize the song. At the, like hearing it,
at
then
the
I recognized it as Moby, and I was like, "Oh wow, cool! It's Moby." And we also have Mulder, like being Mulder, doing the slide projector.
Oh yes, of course, and like bopping along to the music as Scully walks in carrying their lunch.
Yeah, it's casual Saturday, Mulder.
I know, poor Scully.
Poor Scully.
She brought lunch for him on a Saturday, and he wants her to work. Mulder, so she begins telling him about the autopsy results, which are kind of gross. A woman who,
yeah,
margarita mix, drowning her own margarita mix. Not very spooky.
No, not very spooky at all. But then, like, Mulder gets into this whole fractals and the Mandelbrot set, and that stuff that's pretty interesting.
You did like that part.
Yeah. Well, what I found really interesting about that is Mulder is talking about like how this mathematical model. I'm not going to like go into detail on the Mandelbrot set, but I did look it up to like refresh my memory. But like he talked about how this mathematical model could predict crop circles, what they would look like, and where they were going to be, and how they're very like how they're very complex. The images are very complex. And it just made me wonder, well, like, if you could predict it with a mathematical model, like, isn't it more of, like, a natural phenomenon rather than aliens doing it? Or, like, is it aliens doing it on a predictable schedule? Is it natural phenomena but extraterrestrial? Like, I started going into this whole thing, but...
I have no idea. I didn't understand most of what he was saying, so I'm glad that you're here to tell us a little bit about it.
I mean, I think, like, the main thing to know about Mandelbrot is that, you know, he discovered, you know, the Mandelbrot set, which creates this really complex image where we're at the edge, every little piece of the edge is like a smaller version of the larger piece.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so Mandelbrot, like, then in the 80s went on to write a book called, like, called The Fractal Geometry of Nature, where he talked about how shapes in nature are not necessarily... They're not necessarily exactly that mathematically, but how they're so complex that, like, clouds are not spheres. It was one of his quotes: clouds are not spheres, mountains are not cones, coastlines are not circles. So it's just sort of, it's sort of an interesting, like, aside just about the complexity of nature and, you know, are these crop circles natural or not, is sort of what I feel like is unsaid by Mulder.
That's very interesting, and that's very Mulder.
Yeah.
That's absolutely something that Mulder would investigate and look into all the way over in England, which that's a tall order for Scully. I don't know if the FBI has any jurisdiction there, but
yes. Or like sure if the FBI will pay for this for them. their expense reports.
I hope he's paying. No, I don't think that the FBI is paying for any of this. But I do find the crop circles interesting, and I know that Jillian chose them because they look so similar to the chakras that we see later in the episode. But the circular nature of it just automatically reminded me of the Ouroboros, which I don't think that was intentional, and I might be looking too much into it.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it just took me, it's a Scully-centric episode.
Yeah.
Circle, I'm going too much into it, as I said, but that's where my mind originally went. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I listened to the commentary and did some reading and found out that she actually chose it because of the chakras. So, but it's also something that Mulder would be interested in.
Yeah.
Because aliens, of course.
Of course.
And so Scully's completely disinterested in what Mulder is saying. She's just like digging into her salad. I'm thinking that looks like an amazing salad. Like, she's really into it while Mulder's talking.
Yes, and being very careful about how much dressing she puts on.
Oh, yeah. Not too much, Scully. Not too much. And Mulder's not wearing any pants, apparently.
Yeah. Right.
Which she doesn't seem to care about.
So I'm just going to throw in a quick, like, headcanon thing about, like, because there's very rarely food on the X-Files, too. And, like, at this point, like, in my head, we've been going, okay, season two, like, there were ribs, there were fried chicken. Mm-hmm. In Dreamland, there's the message of, like, the yogurt and bee pollen. And then The Unnatural, there's, like, the tofutti rice dreamsicle. Now Scully's having a salad. And at this point, I'm like, Scully has gone vegan. This is my headcanon. but then that was completely ruined by followers when she was eating the sushi. And I was so sad.
But if she's you said yogurt and bee pollen, right, in Dreamland?
Yeah, so I feel like she sort of, like, went from, like, okay, like, it was, like, meat in season two, and then it was, like, okay, yogurt and bee pollen, it's, like, you know.
Okay.
And then to the tofutti. It was a progression.
That's true. You know, maybe occasional vegan. I think Gillian Anderson was vegan for a while, right? Wasn't she on an episode of the Rosie O'Donnell show, and she brought her some sort of vegan... something like sugarless tofu pie.
Oh, really?
And
I didn't remember that.
I have to look this up. We are so off base here in what we should be talking about.
Yes, but I know. I felt like I had to just get that one in because it makes me laugh every time. But yeah, I know. It's not really.
No, but that's interesting. I will pay more attention to what I'm doing a rewatch. So now cool. I'm still in season one. So, you know, we're on fried chicken and ribs and everything. She eats everything right now. But yeah, I'll pay more attention. I'll get back to you in a
year
or so whenever I'm done. So let's see.
I find it interesting here also that similar to The Unnatural, it's Saturday and they're in the basement office. They're having somewhat of a similar conversation as they did in The Unnatural or like in Dreamland. It's like, you know, why are we always running to the next thing? You know, why don't we like get out of the damn car, or, you know, like, that sort of thing. And it, well, I think what Scully actually says is, why don't you ever just stay still? Just sort of a callback to the same sort of like mini conflict that they mm-hmm. have.
The bit of frustration. Yeah. And so Mulder's on his way. He's making plans to go. He'll cancel her ticket. And then we get this cool transition to the hospital. We have, the burrito falls.
And yeah, the burrito falls.
Clicks the projector mm-hmm. clicky thingy. Very technical term. The button.
Yeah.
Whatever makes the projector work. And then you get the tapping of the pencil at the hospital where Scully is finishing the autopsy, or she gets the final results. Interesting note here, which I only learned from watching the commentary, is the blonde woman who hands Scully the results is the blonde woman that we see in the hat later walking down the street.
Yes, I also learned this from the commentary.
I had no idea. I mean, it just flashes on her for a
it's
second.
So fast.
You really
yeah.
don't see her face. Yeah. So I thought that was really cool. So there is a mix-up with the autopsy results. She actually ends up getting someone else's x-rays from the nurse. And, you know, it's kind of a weird thing. It's someone that she actually knows. What are the odds of that? We were talking earlier about the themes from a previous episode. And this is kind of a callback for me to Goldberg Variation. Cause and effect and luck and, you know, what are the odds that she would end up with Daniel Waterston's x-ray results after he had been in Washington, D.C. for 10 years and she never ran into him. How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I love the facial expression when she sees the name. How, you get so much out of it. Like, you really know something's up if you've never seen this before. It's funny how the Goldberg variation, because it's so close to this in time, also dealt mm-hmm. with some of the same things. And I would also say, Clyde Bruckman, sort of in a different way. But the way he talked about, you know, the odds of, I forget which musician was which, winning the coin toss and getting to go on the plane, and then the plane crashes, and all the events that led up to that, and what's the probability of each single one? Like, you could really sort of go down a rabbit hole just thinking about that.
Everything in her life and everything in Waterston's life have brought them to this time and place, and that's saying a lot. I mean, is it fate? Is it chance? That's probably, you know, a callback to Monday. Do we have any say? Do we have any free will? Or was this all predetermined?
Yeah, that's another episode that deals with similar themes.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking a lot about Monday in this one. A lot. But we're not quite sure who this guy is. You get the feeling, as you said, that he's probably pretty important. I mean, I think, if I remember correctly, I got the feeling that, oh, they were romantic together just from the emotional reaction that she had initially. Do you remember if you had, put it together when you first watched it?
I'm pretty sure that was my inkling.
Yeah.
That it was, somebody she was more romantically involved with based on the facial expression.
And so Scully is called out of the room by the doctor, and I'm thinking, oh, she's in the wrong room. She's in trouble. But no, Daniel Waterston has been talking about his former student, Dana Scully, to this doctor who he is seeing because he has a heart condition, a very serious heart condition, and is being treated.
Yeah. I what I think is very interesting about – well, there's two things. You get this big surprise on Scully's face when – the cardiologist says that Daniel has mentioned her. So now, if you didn't have an inkling before, now you really do. What's interesting about his actual heart condition is, I was trying to listen to the things they were saying about what was actually wrong. And they're saying, oh, we did an echo and he had an upper respiratory infection. So we did this biopsy. And I'm looking all this up to see what actually is going on with him. And so the best I can come up with is if these things were going on, he had an upper respiratory infection and they did biopsy of the heart muscle, then he may have myocarditis, which is sort of interesting because it's something like they mentioned the upper respiratory infection, like this has a very clear cause that is not spiritual or supernatural. And I wonder yeah. how intentional that was, or how much that's supposed to like feed into the story, or like feed into the ambiguity over all that we get to later.
Yes. I also felt that they kept it very vague, and I kept listening. I'm like, what is wrong with his heart? Did he have a heart? They didn't say anything, but I don't think the actual problem is, at least in Scully's journey here, is not that he had a heart condition, but that he had a crisis of the soul that was making him sick. And so it does seem that it was kept purposely vague so that no medicine is going to really be able to treat what he has.
And it had to be the heart, because, you know, that's, you know, that's the symbol that we need for, you know, love, forgiveness, all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. So it had to be the heart. Scully doesn't really stick around. She seems very uncomfortable, or at least emotional, by what's happening, by seeing Daniel, hearing that he's sick. And so she doesn't wait for him to wake up from the hospital bed. I think the doctor said that they were going to wake him soon from his procedure. So Scully enters her apartment. Again, we have this feeling that there's a heartbeat to the episode. We have the pendulum swinging, keeping time, which is a really cool shot. I really like that.
I like it too.
Yeah. And, okay, in big caps I wrote, did you see her computer?
Oh, really? I didn't even notice. I was paying attention to, like, the wind coming in through the windows. I'm like, oh, that's so nice.
It is very nice. You can see this big old Apple computer from, you know, one of the colorful ones. I think it was blue or something. It's so cool. And just, once again, like, the music. And I think they mentioned the Blair Witch Project earlier in the episode. It just, like, puts you in a time and place. And you're like, all right, late 90s, early 2000s, here we go.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's like what I like so much about the Moby song being in there, is that like it really like transports me to that time. And I can sort of remember like where I was when I first, or not where I was, just like where I was in my life, you know, at that time.
No, absolutely. That's how I feel about DPO, actually.
Oh, same.
Like, I watch it and I'm like, well, I guess I should go listen to Blink 182 or something now. Green Day. Where's Green Day? Come on. I watched it a few months ago, and that's exactly how I felt after. I was like, well, it's time. No, Blink 182 came later. That was late 90s, right?
Yeah, a little later.
I think I'm thinking of Green Day when I watch when I watch DPO. So yeah, same thing with this. I really feel like I'm back in the early 2000s, and the computer that I noticed was one of the ways that the episode helps with that. And so she steps in the door, and immediately Maggie calls saying that Daniel wants to see her, and Scully is pretty hesitant, understandably. Mulder calls, because obviously he needs something from her on a Saturday. And he asks if she can pick up something for the case that he's working on. From, I think he said, one of the scientists.
Yes, one of the researchers who lives near the hospital, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, Scully says, just leave me the information and I'll go get it. So Scully does end up going to the hospital, hesitant as she is. And by chance walks into the wrong room, and we see a familiar face, Colleen Flynn from Detour, which I thought was really cool. I like that they brought her back. Scully goes to the correct room, and she has this emotional reunion with Daniel, who's awake now. Maggie, the daughter, is very upset, and she storms out, which she does a lot of in the episode, understandably so.
Yeah, she's definitely – the anger is, like, very – it seems very fresh. You wonder how much, like, she and her dad have talked over these past 10 years. How, like, it's interesting because we never really see her direct her anger at him.
No.
Which might just, but he's also really sick, so you're not really sure what's going on between the two of them exactly. But it's definitely, like, you definitely get the feeling that it's uncomfortable, but you don't know, like, how much anger there is.
that's really interesting that you say that it's fresh, because obviously they, Scully and Daniel split over 10 years ago. But yeah, Maggie is angry as if it had just happened. And yeah, I never really thought of it that way. Or maybe just seeing Scully in her life again has brought up old feelings and she's like, I can't deal with this. I'm out of here.
That makes sense. And also, I think if you, you were talking earlier about how Jillian's original script, like some of this stuff was a lot heavier, like actually, the wife ended up dying by suicide, not just getting divorced. And like, so the anger was supposed to be would have been a lot, you know, bigger.
And Maggie found her hanging.
Yeah, like that. I feel like was something that's just like, it's just too heavy of baggage to like have never been mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
Like by Scully.
Well, I don't know if she would have known.
Oh, she may not have known. That's true.
If she moved away and then whatever, a year later, Daniel came after her, or not even after her, just to live in close proximity to her. Maybe she never knew. I don't know.
Well, and also she wasn't supposed to have actually had an affair with Daniel in the original.
Right.
It's like, it's a way more complicated situation.
Yeah.
Or confusing, at least.
It's more interesting that she did have the affair.
I think so, yeah.
And that we get this tension and that Daniel still needs to realize that it's his fault and not Scully's for leaving. And that he has to come to that acceptance. Whether we're talking about the medical aspect of this or not, it's still something that he needs to come to terms with and heal with his daughter. Because that is not a healthy relationship.
No. So just in sort of the general Scully, you know, dating someone who's one of her instructors, I kind of like that Jillian took that, like, from Lazarus and sort of built on it. Like, oh, maybe this is Scully's pattern. That she falls for guys who, you know, are in a sort of an authority position. Because I think that, I don't remember the agent's name in Lazarus, but he was like one of her instructors at Quantico.
Jack Willis?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did like that a lot. I thought that was a cool way to just like, to pull something from so long, you know, from season one and build on it. Another thing that Jillian says in the commentary, and it comes up in the scene, is about how Daniel has to seem very appealing to Scully in this episode to really, I guess, to bring about like Scully's whole emotional journey. She has to really think about whether she made the right decision all those years ago and whether it's like if he's just supposed to be symbolic of her leaving, symbolic of the decision to stay in medicine, or if we're really talking about both decisions, like staying with him and staying in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they really like accomplished that. Like he's kind of like, he's very persuasive. He's very like, Scully, I know what you want. I know what's good for you. I know you want this. You know, it's like, he's just so confident that like nothing has changed. That this is what Scully's heart longs for. And I think he actually says exactly that. You know, I know your heart longs for, or I represent what your heart longs for. And I'm just watching this like in awe of his confidence. But it's definitely, so you definitely get you get the idea that he's sort of a dominant authoritative presence and was in her life. And that's one of the things she's sort of looking at, whether that's something she wants.
And it kind of harkens back to Never Again when she's talking about these father figures. And along those same lines, Beyond the Sea, where her dad disapproved of her joining the FBI and so on. So it seems like she had a lot of that in her life. And, well, Jillian decided to write more of that. But she really borrowed from, like, these core ideas, this base that Scully had, and built on them. And I think it kind of stuck because I don't know if you read any fanfic, but a lot of it deals with that sort of aspect of her life, kind of like the father figure and breaking away from that. And so it made an impression on people.
Yeah.
Clearly made an impression on Jillian.
Yeah. And I do like, I sort of, I like that as a pattern for her, but like, going back to what we talked about, how this is the first episode that was written by a woman, or no, it's the second one, right? Well, it's the first one, it was the only one Jillian wrote, but so few were written by women, I think.
Right.
Quagmire was written by Kim Newton, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the only other one up to this point, even if it's like three, it's a tiny number. Yeah. You know, so in Never Again, I really feel like that conversation she has in the bar with Ed Jurse, yes, the conversation that she has with Ed is like the wrong conversation. It's this very like generic talk about like stealing her mother's cigarettes and her dad was going to be mad. Uh-huh. It's just like, this could be any teenager. Like, this isn't what is bothering her, and this is not what she would be talking about. And I have felt like if a woman was writing that part of it, at least, it would have been different. It would have been more like what's actually bothering Scully, which is not about her dad. Like, I don't know. I always feel like too much goes back to her dad that's just not that just doesn't make sense. Like, even the whole idea to me that her dad disapproved of her joining the FBI, like, that's all sort of vague. Like, we never know why. And, like, why, as, like, a Navy captain or whatever he was, would he disapprove? Why would he be disappointed in this? Was he worried that it was too dangerous? Like, we never get any of
that. They never really say. They made it seem more like he's disappointed that she's leaving medicine.
Yeah.
To join the FBI because medicine's... maybe there's more money in medicine and you put all this time and effort into it. And why would you leave after, you know, putting however many years of your life into it? That's my headcanon. It seems more like, was he disappointed that I left medicine for the FBI rather than, oh God, she's joining the FBI. Just that sole thing, reason, purpose.
Yeah. It's just that is a thing I wonder about a lot because it is so vague, but also like, Scully's dad is such a big presence sort of on the show, even though he has passed away in season one. It's something I wonder about a lot.
There are a lot of things that are possibly intentionally left vague so that Chris Carter can bend them to his will, I think.
Yeah, like sort of leaving the options open so you can decide later.
Mm-hmm. It seems like... Or maybe it was just an afterthought. I'm like, oh, yeah, Scully's dad didn't approve. right. Moving on, guy who can communicate with the dead, let's go. So, you know, maybe back then it wasn't quite – they weren't thinking about it in terms of character development with family, I guess. I guess they could have built on it more, but this – I think this really does harken back to – to her dad, just because he does make it a point to say, like, you left medicine. Why would you do that?
Yeah, in that way, definitely.
Yeah.
And, like, I think it's in this scene that, Daniel, like, gets at least two shots in at her about leaving medicine, like, in this short conversation.
Yeah. So Scully ends up leaving the hospital, and Mulder calls her with information where she can go pick up the file for his case.
And seeing someone driving in the car holding a phone to their ear in 2021 is jarring.
Yes. It wasn't the rule back then. It wasn't the law, I should say.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they couldn't pull you over for that back then, I don't think.
No, and so she almost gets into this car accident, another mistake after having just walked into the wrong hospital room, and she's almost hit by this truck after almost hitting a woman with long blonde hair. So she's a little startled by that. She ends up at Colleen's house to pick up the file. She's not exactly nice to Colleen, who's perfectly nice to her. I don't really, you know, I mean, maybe she's talking about things that Scully's not quite ready to hear, I guess.
That's interesting because that's how I always saw it. And then when I watched it again last week, I was like, wow, Colleen's actually kind of rude too. Like, I feel like she's giving the unsolicited advice to someone she met 5 seconds ago and doesn't know anything about. And she's kind of like, she's a little arrogant about it. Like, I know that you're going too fast and you need to slow down. I know that you're not paying attention. I know that you've already judged me. And like, And I never picked up on that until, and then it was funny because I've watched it like 3 or 4 times this past week. And then when I watched it again today, I was like, I don't know. Scully is like a little bit, like she makes a comment early on about, Colleen says, oh, you're here, you know, about my research. And Scully says, I'm like, oh yeah, for the FBI, as odd as that may sound. So like, she sort of gets that in at the beginning. And then, so I sort of feel like it's both of them.
I can see that maybe, you know, Scully's more of a private person. She didn't ask for the advice. So I can definitely buy that, that maybe it rubbed her the wrong way. And as she leaves, once again, she has another accident, which keeps happening to her. She's not paying attention. She needs to slow down. And she sees the heart chakra, which looks a lot like the crop circle.
I am trying to understand why there was paperwork about the heart chakra in there. Like, was it related to the crop circles? Because that's what Scully was there to pick up. And, like, I did do a pause to look at all the papers. And, like,
anything really interesting? Close.
Well, it looked like it was a mix of, like, the autopsy report that Scully may have already had in her hands, which didn't look like it was in her hands, but it was definitely something, some sort of medical test results. And then there was, like, a thing about, like, the math of the Mandelbrot set. And then there was, like, the heart chakra. And so I was wondering if the heart chakra was, if it was related to the crop circles, or if it was just supposed to be a coincidence that it just got in there by mistake. But, like, yeah. And this is also where the actual phrase all things comes up, or one place it does is when Colleen says there's a greater intelligence in all things.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so we'll probably get into this a little more later, but one thing I find sort of interesting, when I think of the phrase all things, I think of the idea of like seeing the divine in all things, seeing God in all things, or all things are one, all things are connected, which is sort of mm-hmm. like this idea that's in a lot of the Eastern religions and philosophies that would inspire kindness and reverence for other people, nature, animals, whatever, because, you know, God is in everything. But anyway, this is something that is notably absent in Christianity, which is just something I like tucked in the back of my head when I heard Joseph Campbell say it. And Darren Moody talked a whole bunch about Joseph Campbell in Amor Fati. But mm-hmm. So I sort of think that Scully could be at a place in her life right now where, like, post-Sixth Extinction, she's seen the ship with, like, the writings from all the different religions on it, that she mm-hmm. might be, like, thinking about her faith in maybe a different way than she thought about it before, and might be sort of open to what are things from other faiths that are potentially useful or good or whatever. So that's something I wonder about in this episode. Whether after during season 7, like after the Sixth Extinction, Scully is thinking about her religion, her faith in somewhat of a different way. And I think that's sort of what Jillian was trying to say about Scully, was like, well, what she said in the commentary was like, she was hopeful that Scully would go on more of a spiritual than a religious path. That might be a tall order, but I think that like the idea that Scully would be open to ideas from other religions is, you know, perfectly reasonable, especially at this point in the show when like the Sixth Extinction has just happened.
I can't imagine that she wouldn't be, given everything that she's seen. And it does, Jillian might have said this as well in the commentary, that this does mark kind of the beginning of Scully believing in more, not necessarily spiritually, but just moving on to the next season where she does become more of the believer. So it's an interesting episode in that way, that it does kind of set her on this path. And I kind of like that Jillian was the one who wrote it, you know?
Yeah.
Herself seems very spiritual. She's talked a lot about Buddhism and has recommended these more like spiritual books. I don't know if they're specifically Tibetan or Buddhist books, but more like spiritual healing and stuff like that.
I agree with what you said about Scully is sort of becoming more of a believer. I think in the Sixth Extinction and also here, it's like, this is, I wrote that, like, I think it's sort of a beginning of a theme that goes into a season of Scully sort of trying to be a little more like Mulder.
So Scully is summoned to Daniel's hospital room for an educated medical opinion on a treatment that he wants to pursue. You seem to have done a lot of research on the more technical mumbo jumbo of the episode. So I was gonna ask if you knew what they were talking about here. I just was like, yep, medicine, Scully knows it.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. One thing is, like, they mentioned digoxin, which is actually a little bit of a callback to Eve. It's, oh, you know, it was originally derived from the foxglove flower, digitalis, okay, like that whole thing. It's a cardiac glycoside.
Did you know that or did you look it up?
No, I'm very impressed. I knew that. Well, in graduate school, I studied the cardiovascular system, so.
Okay, well, there you go. That's great.
So it's, you know, I didn't just know it, like, you know, completely out of the top of my head.
Sure.
But
you had some sort of background in that.
I had heard of it before. And so, but, like, once we get past that, they talk about, like, you know, high doses of digoxin, and then they mention prednisone, and I'm like, I guess that's to, like, tamp down the inflammation from, because, you know, the infection, the myocarditis, whatever. But also, and he's got arrhythmia, which I think can be a complication of that. But I don't know. Like, I feel like, okay, Scully's not a cardiologist. Like, you know.
Like, I'm sorry. Scully performs brain surgery, so I think she can handle this.
I think, like, well, what I mean by that is, like, I think it was just, it was a way for Daniel to get her to come back in. It wasn't really to get her opinion. Like, they could have asked many other doctors at the hospital for their opinion.
Oh, sure. But hers was the medical opinion that he trusted.
That he trusted. Yeah, I think that's really the point. Like, he trusted her opinion.
Yeah.
More than, you know, anybody else.
And, or he knew that she would back him up because he's the one who taught her.
Maybe. I don't know.
So self-serving?
Also, could be. This is where we find out that Daniel has been in DC for 10 whole years. And, like, this for me, I don't know, I feel like Daniel's holding of the torch for Scully is, like, a little bit over the top in this episode. Like, the fact that he moved to DC 10 years ago and just, like, never called her, never tried to contact her, you know, is talking about her heart longs for him. I don't know. I think it's, like, it's just, like, it's a little too much.
It's very much the male gaze that we got, maybe not so explicitly, mm-hmm, but that we got from Monday, where Paget moved into Mulder's.
Milagro.
Milagro, sorry, yeah. Milagro, yes.
Gotcha.
Sorry. Monday, Milagro, yes. From Milagro, where Paget moves into this building to be close to Scully because he knows that she always visits Mulder there. But doesn't actually, well, I guess Paget does make contact. He does attempt to reach out to her, whereas Daniel never did. Had she not been at that hospital at the right time and gotten the wrong information, she never would have known. I don't know what his game plan was. Like,
yeah,
just wait around another 20 years and see if she finds him, hang out at coffee shops until she walks in. But it's creepy, and you get the sense that maybe he has been watching her the way that Paget has been watching her, had been watching her.
That is a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way, and that is a little creepy.
It's really creepy and made me very uncomfortable. I mean, I'm sure it makes most people uncomfortable when you really sit and think about it. But most of all, I'm bewildered because I don't know what his plan was.
Yeah.
Just move to the city to be close to her and nothing. And I don't know.
I don't think we know, like, where she went to medical school, like where he would have lived before. I mean, I think we know where she went to undergrad. I think that was, like, University of Maryland. I think that was, like, in the Jersey Devil, we find that out. But
yeah,
I'm not sure about medical school. So I'm not really sure, like, how far did he actually move?
Right. Was it across the country?
Was it across the country? Yeah.
You know, half a state away? I don't really know, but it's disturbing.
Yeah. Scully says a couple of interesting things in this scene. She says something about, like, you've come at this really weird time, and he says to her, you have a life, and she says, I don't know what I have. And he asks her, what do you want? And she says, I want everything I should want at this time in my life. Just, like, way to make it vague. And then she says, you know, maybe I want the life I didn't choose. I guess it's, like, purposely ambiguous. So we're not really sure what's going on in her head. It's funny how hearing her say the life I didn't choose, how watching it today in my 40s, like, it just, like, speaks to me in a completely different way than it did when I first saw this. I was like, sure. Oh, okay, I get that now. But yeah, I want everything I should want at this time in my life is, like, you could read so much into that. I thought that was a very interesting line.
I always took it to mean the settling down with, you know, a husband, have some children in the suburbs, drive a minivan. Maybe not necessarily with Daniel Waterston, but her life seems very busy. She wants to stay still for one Saturday, and Mulder, you know, keeps asking things of her.
And I do think she's actually a little bit lonely, because as much as she and Mulder are together, they're not, like, really together necessarily, yeah, that we know of, you know, at least not, right, like they live separate. Like, can you imagine living with Mulder? So they live separately. You know, so they have this this relationship that's, like, it's way less like toxic than it used to be. Like, it, you know, there were, sure, like, points of it that were, like, you know, it's that it was I like to say it was, like, all-encompassing but, like, also incomplete. And but, like, it seems like in season 7 it's like a little bit better now, but there has to be some loneliness because they both work so much and they sort of work parallel, like, sometimes together, not always, mm-hmm, together. They're not really, like, life companions exactly. And so, like, you know, when we see Daniel, like, you know, touch her hand, you know, hold her hand or whatever, it's like, and you see the way she reacts, like, I sort of get, that's what I get from that, is that she does feel kind of lonely.
And you get the sense that there's not, though it's not explicitly said, there's not a lot of family around her. Not that she doesn't want to see her mother, but again, she's just so busy working and Mulder, you know, having Mulder usurp her time, that maybe it's not always easy to see family either, or maintain, right, well, friendships.
And about her family, I think this is something that also, like, perhaps a female writer could have done. You know, like, maybe a woman would have felt this more, that, like, Scully's relationship with her family, like, after, you know, Melissa being murdered because of this work that Scully does, and how, like, every time she's with her family, that's in the room with them, and Melissa's not, you know, it's just
a constant, like, reminder.
Yeah, it's like, it's a constant reminder, and, you know, yeah, and she's still doing that work, and, you know, we know at least Bill Scully does not like it, and so, like, I think her family relationships are probably really complicated.
Back to kind of Scully. Well, my opinion that Scully may want possibly, you know, quote unquote, the life that she didn't choose. The family, the husband, the picket fence. So thinking back to Amor Fati, if that was Mulder's last temptation, I kind of feel like this is Scully's last temptation, where she does have the chance to see Daniel one last time and reassess who she is. And did she actually want the life with him, and kind of the baggage of, like, breaking up this family, but also possibly, you know, having the ability to have children. And so Scully is given that opportunity, and it's not quite the same way. They're not exactly the same parallels, but for me, having her say these words, you know, her emotional turmoil here, really reminded me of that Mulder having his dreams, nightmare. I don't know exactly, yeah, what it was.
That's very delusions. Interesting. Like, how those sort of do mirror each other. I hadn't thought of, like, I feel like now I sort of want to watch Amor Fati and then watch All Things right after, and, like, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Because Mulder is given all these things and the world goes to hell. And Scully's not quite granted that. She, you know, she only has her. She doesn't have the dreams, but she has the.
She has, like,
emotions going through her. And she wonders, well, would I have been happy? And they are trying to make Daniel as appealing as possible. And so it really is giving her a cause to think about it. But I, too, now would like to watch Amor Fati and see if I can draw more parallels, because I didn't watch it before this. Just I had listened to the episode and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Listened to the X-Cast episode. And that's, yeah, what kind of made me think about it in those terms. And I honestly don't know that she would have been happy with Daniel. I mean, obviously, if that's what this episode's all about, really. And so we have this emotional moment where Scully puts her head on Daniel's chest, I think presumably listening to his sick heart. And the monitor starts beeping erratically. I think Jillian was saying that she originally didn't want the monitors to beep. She wanted it to be this very quiet moment between them, but there wasn't enough of a dramatic moment for this time in the episode, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was something about she wanted Scully to sense that something was going on.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Before, and so, like, there is a moment where she sort of picks her head up and then puts it back down, where I think that's supposed to be where she senses something's wrong, but I don't think you necessarily get that unless you hear Jillian say it. Like, I never got it before.
No, it wasn't until the monitor started beeping. I thought she was just relaxed in the moment and enjoying it.
Yeah. Which I think, that's always what I got from it. It was like she relaxed for like just a second and then and then everything starts beeping.
Right. And so this brings her back to Colleen's house.
Yes. But of course, first she just takes charge and starts doing the chest compressions and ordering the nurses around because, like, you know, she's Scully.
Thank you. Total badass. Scully. Yes. I don't know how I could have just skipped that. I was like, well, Colleen. No. Yeah, Scully takes charge of a room in a hospital where she does not work. So, but she does a really good job. It's very dramatic and well played. And then she ends up at Colleen's house where Colleen's partner lets Scully inside. And Scully is just absolutely mesmerized by the decor. I guess it's nothing like she's ever seen before. Actually, you were around and 2000. Do you remember when everyone was really into Buddhism and everyone had a little Buddha in their home? Okay. I talked to my husband about it. He was like, no, what are you talking about?
No, yeah. Buddhism was trendy at this point in time. And this is like a lot of like sort of Eastern stuff. It's like this is right after like 1997 was when like Madonna released Ray of Light and had that song that was all in Sanskrit. It was, and she was, you know, talking about yoga and like, yeah, Buddhism was trendy. And then, like, there's, like, The Power of Now, which I think is one of the books that Jillian mentions in, like, an interview about this episode, which came out around this time. And, like, yeah, like, all the cool kids were going Buddhist. Like, that just seemed to be what was happening.
So something big for at least the late 90s, early 2000s happens in this scene, and that you have a same-sex kiss on screen.
Yes. And Scully just totally try to play it cool.
Yeah. Don't stare. Yeah.
Which I just love that part. But yeah, you're right. Like, I've always thought about it from the perspective of, like, Scully trying to play it cool. But yeah, you did not really see that then, did you?
No. I think Ellen had come out, I want to say, 2 or 3 years earlier.
Yeah, it was definitely earlier.
In her show. But it didn't really enter more mainstream culture until later.
But I do like that this kiss is, like, it's so, like, casual and in the background that it's just, like, no big deal.
Yeah, and I like that that's how it's portrayed rather than making a big deal about
it. Exactly.
Something that people do.
It's just, like, it's just normal thing.
Let's move on with our lives and talk about aliens, all right.
Yeah.
Right?
And crop circles.
And crop circles, yeah. So
I do love that. I really love the house, like the set, set design wise.
Yeah,
they did an amazing job. Like the art on the walls. Jillian said in the commentary, some of the paintings were done by a friend of hers. Mm-hmm. They have this like really pretty floral wallpaper that's somehow not tacky. There's like candles, all these books. They even had like I noticed there's a photo of Paramahansa Yogananda, writer, the author of Autobiography of a Yogi, which is. Again, one of those books you end up reading if you take a like a yoga teacher training or something. It was just like the attention to detail and like all the wood sculpture, like the beautiful wood sculpture. I just thought this house, like, I want to live in this house.
And it feels warm and welcoming and just full of love, really, as opposed to, and again, I'm not that perceptive, but in contrast to what Jillian said, Daniel's room is supposed to be like, which is like shaded in these blues and very cold and sterile. And so you really get the feeling that this is a house of love and peace and I guess spiritual healing. But yeah, they did a great job with the set design and the attention to detail. It feels, you know, it's not just a house that you walk into. It's very populated and lived in. Scully apologizes for how she acted the other night with Colleen and then asks her to elaborate on slowing down. She's noticed that she has been having a lot of kind of like mistakes and accidents.
Yeah. And I think it's more of the, for Scully, like there's like the mention of like, oh, I don't have a lot of time and I'm in a hurry, but it really seems to be more like not paying attention. Like she's distracted. She's thinking about something else. Well, like she's doing one thing and thinking about something else.
That is me every single day.
And I like that they made Colleen a physicist because that sort of makes sense as to why she might be interested in doing this really complex mathematical modeling about crop circles.
Yes. So I had mentioned at the beginning of the episode that I had a reason why I thought that this was not Mulder and Scully's first time, and it happens in this scene.
Really?
And it has to do with Colleen being a physicist. Mm-hmm. She talks about having contracted cancer. And she was in a relationship that she was afraid to admit to the outside world, to friends, family. And so she didn't talk about it, and they weren't public. And Scully is a brilliant doctor who had cancer and I think is in a secret relationship with Mulder that she is afraid to come out to the world for whatever reason. Maybe they'll look down on her. Maybe she doesn't want to be looked down on by the world, or not the world, but you know,
the FBI.
Partners sleeping together at work. Yeah. Not that she's ashamed of him, because I don't think that's the case at all. And for me, this is what solidifies it.
All right, that is blowing my mind. Like, I never made that connection of like, you know, getting cancer and also being, you know, in a relationship that I couldn't tell anybody about. That, wow. I have to, like, sit with that for a while.
Take your time. Take your time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what did it for me. I'm not trying to start a war. That's just – no Twitter wars, people. No Twitter wars.
But I think you could, like – you could interpret it. You could interpret it that way even if it wasn't, like, a sexual relationship. Because, like, sure. We were talking about with, like, Scully sort of having to deal with this relationship with Mulder, with her family, with other people at the FBI.
Absolutely.
She always has to defend him. To people at the FBI. So, yeah, you could see that.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be sexual in nature that or romantic in nature even. That's how I'm taking it. But yeah, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. But Colleen talks about having to come to terms with this before she can really heal herself. I really do get the feeling that Scully's looking for guidance. Not only for Daniel, but for herself. She doesn't want to make these mistakes, and she is looking for the signs in her life that she has made the right decision and is where she needs to be. And so twofold, I think these are the reasons that she has come to Colleen.
I think, so yeah, there's a couple of things happening. Like, I still really think that Colleen maybe could remind her of Melissa. And I also think that Scully's sort of, she's having this moment where she's noticing things that she has not noticed before. She's wondering whether there are signs out there that she's supposed to be paying attention to when she makes decisions that maybe she wasn't paying attention to. So she's trying to do things a little bit differently right now. So I think like those are the reasons she's showing up here to Colleen. This is, so this sort of, what Colleen says here, like this is actually the main thing I don't like about this episode is idea of like I'm fine with, I totally get like the cancer getting her attention. Like this is a thing that happens. Somebody has a health scare and you know, that makes you like take stock, reassess your priorities, maybe decide to prioritize like your emotional well-being over like, you know, your work, which maybe like is not fulfilling to you. And like that I totally get. But I don't like this, like, we seem to get the implication that the emotional stress was like the single factor And like once she dealt with that, her cancer went into remission, which is just, it's just like, it's like too simplistic. And like, I think to Jillian's credit, like Scully has trouble believing this. Like she clearly has trouble believing this story because of course she's an MD. Of course she would. And it's like, you know, our emotional state, it's a factor in our health. It's a very big factor, but it's still like one factor of many. And like, if you know anything about the biology of cancer, like it's just not realistic. And it also feeds into this whole idea of like, because Colleen says like everything happens for a reason, which I think has like, it's a thing people say and it's a thing a lot of people believe, but I think it has this real dark side where like, okay, so if Colleen did get sick, what if she didn't get the message, right? Does that mean like that the cancer would have killed her and like that would have been okay because she didn't get the lesson? Like, I don't know. It's like, it's one of those things that I think sounds really good when it's like a happy ending, when you're saying like this bad thing happened and then there was this good thing that came out of it. And I feel like it was a blessing in disguise. But like, if you, like, for someone who maybe, like, parents who have lost a child, or even Scully, whose sister was murdered, like, you can't say to that person, everything happens for a reason. Like, that would be really insensitive.
Right.
This part, like, gets to me. I don't, like, I sort of wish it was, like, pulled back just a little bit to be more of the cancer made me realize that this work I was doing was not fulfilling to me, and I changed all this thing, and I changed all these things, and I'm a happier person now, like, I sort of think that would have been enough without trying to say that, like, dealing with those feelings was the one thing that made her better.
You have pretty much summed up my thoughts on that. Okay. I don't know the biology of cancer, but I do think it's irresponsible to put so much weight on your emotional well-being and not so much weight on the science of it, the medicine. I'll just leave it at that because you summed it up perfectly, as I said. And I guess the next scene we have Scully going back to the hospital with
some lovely flowers.
These beautiful red flowers, right? And Daniel's in a coma again. She's very distraught. She leaves. She's walking through Chinatown and she has her own spiritual experience, I guess, after she finds a Buddhist temple. Her life is kind of flashing before her eyes, but not in, you know, not in the death sort of way, kind of in a personal reassessment of how she got here.
Yeah, I guess she's sort of going through all of her big choices.
Yeah.
Like, that's sort of what I took them in. Like, if the images are going by really fast, you can't really tell, but that's sort of how I interpreted it.
Right. And it's very pretty. They did a great job.
Yes. And I feel like they got really lucky with the day they filmed because the clouds are, like, amazing. Like, they've really...
I don't know if I noticed the clouds. That's interesting.
They're, like, it's, like, not sunny. It's, like, it looks like it could storm soon, but not yet.
Okay.
It's really nice. And, yeah, like you said, the temple, like, the little garden outside the temple and the temple is just, like, yeah, it's really...
It's gorgeous.
And so do you have any thoughts? Like, I feel like at the time, if I remember correctly, the thing that people... One of the things that people had a problem with was, like, just Scully, like, meditating in a Buddhist temple or having visions in a Buddhist temple because, you know, she's Catholic and that doesn't make sense, blah, blah, blah. I don't really interpret it that way at all. Like, sort of what we were talking about before, like, I think I can sort of connect it with the sixth extinction where she's probably sort of reevaluating religion and, like, maybe how literally she takes her Catholicism, which we don't really know how literally she takes everything. And, you know, she's seen all the world's religions together, like, written down on the ship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think she could probably at this point be thinking about what's useful in other faiths, and she could probably, you know, get a message from God in a Buddhist temple just the same as she could anywhere else. I think that would fit her journey where she is right now.
That makes a lot of sense. And as Colleen had said earlier in the episode, she's more open-minded than she realizes. And because of that, I buy it. I don't think she's switching to Buddhism. I don't think she's dropping Catholicism or anything like that. I think it's just part of the journey for her. And if this particular journey takes her to a Buddhist temple, then so be it. I don't think it's really problematic.
No. And I think it is. It's a day where she's trying to do things differently than she normally does.
That's true.
Like, she's looking for meaning in these, like, coincidences that she's been experiencing and, like, thinking about whether there are things she needs to pay attention to. And so, like, yeah, she is doing things a little bit differently than she usually would today.
Oh, you know what? I did forget to mention that she does follow her sign. She does follow that woman with the baseball cap into the temple, which seems pretty important. This woman is leading her to where she needs to be.
Yes, which was another interesting thing she mentioned in the commentary was, like, that was not her idea. That was sort of added later as just a way to move the episode along.
Mm-hmm.
That she was only supposed to, like, the sort of near car accident thing was supposed to happen, but that was the only time you were going to see that woman.
Mm-hmm. And then they brought her back. And then,
they brought her back as sort of a way to, like, just get Scully to get to the next place she had to be.
So they're back at the hospital, and Scully's brought a healer in and says that Daniel has unfinished business. That's kind of a really short scene then. And we immediately go into this strange montage of Scully making tea, walking into a hospital room to see herself sick in bed. Very reminiscent of Memento Mori and the Reduxes.
Redux, yeah. So the scene with the healer, it's very short, but I actually have a lot, like, I have a lot written down for it because, okay, so first of all, I really like that, you know, Scully has brought this healer here, but she's clearly very uncomfortable with this and, like, isn't completely on board with it. She's sort of pacing and she sort of looks anxious. And so I think that was good because if Scully bought in too much to this, like, it would not be believable. I don't like the healer. I think he comes off as very unfriendly. But that's just an aside. And okay, so this scene makes me think of One Breath, where Melissa is sort of standing at Scully's bedside, like with her hands over, like she's dangling a crystal over and saying, you know, her soul is here. And, you know, she's telling me not to call you Fox. And what I really would have loved was, like, for this scene to be, like, explicitly a tribute to Melissa in that way.
Aww.
Because, like, the thing about One Breath is, like, Melissa was standing there. And the same thing with Mulder coming back and not staying in his apartment in One Breath was, like, the importance of, like, having someone who loves you there at your side, standing over you with their hands over you or not, but, like, trying to connect to you. Like, I feel like I really would have liked that message more than just, like, this random dude talking about the chakras.
Mm-hmm. See, I took her pacing. Yeah, I just took her pacing as nervousness. I'd have to go back and look now.
Okay.
But I just got that she's like, oh, is this going to work? Not so much that she doubted the healer, although I'm sure that played a part into it. But she was very worried about Daniel because it seems like his situation's pretty dire at this point.
Right. And I also figured she's worrying, like, what am I going to say if his doctor comes in?
Yeah.
Like, that's
just
that's
brought this healer to thinking. The hospital. No.
Yeah,
I'm sure they're used to that, actually.
I think the reaction from the doctor is probably more extreme than something you would actually get. I think it was more about that it wasn't really Scully's place to decide to bring this person in because, you know, she's not family. Because, you know, like, when people come in and pray or, like, you know, no doctor is going to make a big deal about that.
No.
But from Scully's...
And I'm sure they get people of all different religions and beliefs. Yeah.
But so the thing I really liked about this is going back to the idea of, like, Scully occasionally, like, trying to be a little more Mulder. Just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, this calls back to, is this, I'm going to say the wrong episode, but Nothing Happens in Contradiction to Nature, only in contradiction to what we know of it. When, like, that's Scully acknowledging, like, science is not, like, this set of immutable facts, like, in a box. Mm-hmm. It's, like, this constant living thing. It's a process for finding truth. And, you know, good scientists, good physicians know that they don't know everything. And that there are a lot of things with evidence that they work, and we have no idea how they work. We have no idea how the placebo effect works, or the nocebo effect, or acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and these are, you know, things that are pretty well established. And so Scully's sort of taking this view of like, this is a desperate situation. Let's throw everything at this problem that might work. And, you know, I'm in a weird mood today, so let's bring in the chakra guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, and that's, and like, really, it's just, it's, this is what, when people run out of medical options, they do turn to spiritual options. You know, sort of like in Redux, where she had strayed from her faith and, you know, came back. And, you know, she was praying with, you know, praying the rosary with her priest and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I feel like this is Scully being open-minded in an appropriate way. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And I like that she's at least open to the idea. Mm-hmm. I don't like the guy. I would have fired him. But I like
that she's open to another shocker guy.
Yeah, she's just like open to the idea that there might be, you know, something non-medical going on.
And I like that she and Maggie share a moment here. Mm-hmm. Maggie doesn't storm out at this point. She's not combative. It's right. She knows that Scully's just trying to help. And that maybe that's a little bit of Maggie's healing as well.
Yeah. So Scully's looking for meaning, you know, in this whole experience, like making amends with Maggie and sort of like healing, even though they, you know, just to know that someone out there is that angry at you, mm-hmm. you know, like to be able to sort of like heal that relationship. I mean, that would sort of be enough right there to just Absolutely. Say like this experience was meaningful because like this came out of it.
What do you make of her seeing herself sick in the bed that she has? I take it that she has her own healing to do still. Do you have a different interpretation of that?
Yeah, I interpreted that as like the way that Daniel needs to take responsibility for, like, you know, hurting his family or whatever, that maybe Scully has something she needs to address that she's not addressing. Mm-hmm. I never really came up with anything in particular. You know, it's probably some mix of that and also, like, dreams are just weird.
And with that, we jolt awake with another phone call. The phone is ringing. And I have a note here, actually, that says lots of calls in this episode. Yes. And she's told that Daniel is awake. She's down at the hospital. Again, they have another very serious talk. Very presumptuous of Daniel, who keeps wanting to talk about us.
Us,
like, it's a done deal. He's like, we're ready to go. We need to talk about what we're doing next. Yeah,
we've talked for 2 minutes. No, let's move in together. Like,
bold.
I don't get. I mean, maybe some men are like this. I don't know. It seems like way over the top for me, but I guess that's just supposed to be part of his like overconfident, authoritative nature.
And maybe that's what she was attracted to. I don't know. And so he continues on with that, and she's just a different person.
Yeah. And this one also, this scene, okay, is when Scully says, like, it's no coincidence you got sick, like... That one also to me is like it's just like a step too far. Yeah. I feel like that's a step too far for Scully.
Agreed. Agreed.
But again, I just whatever. I can look past that. And really the part about Scully telling him he needs to take responsibility, like I sort of cheer for Scully at that point for like this is someone you get that like she never really stood up to.
Probably. Yes.
And now she is, and again, like, he's sort of, like, he's symbolizing the path that Scully didn't choose, and she's, like, feeling, she's, like, really coming to peace with her choices here.
Yeah, I do like that she urges him to heal his relationship with his daughter, which is really the most important thing. I mean, he says, this isn't you talking, this is Maggie. But Maggie and Scully have not had an actual conversation. Anytime Scully enters the room, Maggie storms out.
Right.
And so, I mean, Daniel doesn't know that. He's been in a coma. He's been sick. But I do like that. That's what Scully said. That's what Scully urges him to do. Because it's really the most important thing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's really, it seems like, sort of like the priorities, like Colleen was talking about, you know, she had the wrong priorities. She was like working 80 hours a week or whatever. Like, in his head, the priority is Scully. But like, you know, but he's not repairing the relationship with his daughter, who is his family. Right.
The only thing I have about that scene is when she enters, I said, look at the color of her sweater. Seems familiar.
Oh, yeah. I wrote that down, too. I'm like, oh, green sweater.
Yep. So she's outside. She leaves the hospital. She's standing outside. The camera slowly, I don't know if the correct word is pans, but it like goes around her. It's a really beautiful scene. Again, very slowed down. You get the feeling that she is reevaluating or just coming to terms with everything in her life. And that's when she sees the woman in the cap again. So, of course, she follows this sign. And the woman leads her to none. Well, the woman is none other than Mulder.
Mulder.
In so Stonehenge weird.
Stonehenge Rocks hat.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, leave it to Mulder to have, like, a bad joke on his hat.
I like it, though. I like puns like that. Yeah, it works.
It's cute. It works on Mulder, definitely.
It does. So they go to Mulder's apartment, and she tells him this whole story of everything that she's been through while he was gone. And I really like how non-judgmental he is. It's, you know, you could see that going a lot of different ways. Like, oh, who do I even know this person? But I love that it's so calm and quiet, and he's so accepting. I like that about them. I'm not even talking in a shippy way, just like this is who they are, and they accept each other, and it's just so beautiful. Yeah. It's a really touching scene.
I agree. And this is like, I think this is like something that like a bunch of episodes in season 7 do really well. If we go back, we've talked about Never Again a couple of times. I feel like this is like another installment of Scully's emotional journey of like analyzing her choices. And it's like at the end of Never Again, I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's ambiguous. It's up in the air. You don't know whether Scully thinks she's made the right choice or not. You don't know whether she thinks she's trapped in this choice and she can't go back. You know, Mulder is really not being accepting. He's being very judgmental. So, like, from there to here, it's like, you know, so Mulder has matured.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Scully is more open. Like, there was definitely a time where if Scully had some sort of vision, she wouldn't tell Mulder.
Right.
Like Elegy, you know, something like that happens because she wouldn't feel comfortable enough. And now she does. And so, yeah, I love like this conversation. And I also like how when God says something about like God spoke to you, Mulder says something about God spoke to you. And Scully says, well, I didn't say God spoke back to me. And I was like, wow, that is very Scully. Like, let's just let's like take it down a notch here.
Yep.
I didn't say God spoke to me. I just said I had some sort of like a vision.
She's only willing to go so far. Let's take it one step at a time, please.
Yeah. So I appreciate that about about Scully. And I just love when she says, I once considered spending my whole life with this man, what I would have missed. Like that as just like the summing up of like, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is where I want to be. And if you look at like how the two of them interact with her over the course of the episode, like Mulder is the one who is like accepting and loving. And Daniel is a little more like selfish and like wanting from her. And yeah, so I just love that, like, we get that sort of closure for Scully that she, like, despite everything, despite, you know, losing her sister, losing her ability to have a child, you know, carry a child, like, everything that's happened, she feels that this is where she's supposed to be and where she wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that.
Same. It's a beautiful ending to the episode. And then she falls asleep and Mulder covers her. It's very touching, very vague. We don't know exactly what happened. Did he carry her back to his room or whatever happened?
Which, like, I sort of like, I'm fine with that because it was meant to be, you were meant to wonder what was happening. It's more interesting that way.
I really like it. It's very X-Files and I think it fits perfectly. Mm-hmm. I'm confused about one thing.
What's that?
Why does Mulder have the Buddha?
Yes! I wrote that down too. I was like, Mulder has a Buddha just like in a bin, like under his fish
tank. Yeah, under the fish tank. I don't really care about it. This is a Scully thing. Did Scully buy it for him on her journey and now?
Or did he get caught up in the all the cool kids are going Buddhist thing?
Maybe.
You know? And maybe. Just decide to buy it. Maybe it was just sort of like a decoration. Did he
did he bring it home from, maybe it was like in the house in Arcadia and he just like brought it home with him.
Yeah, I don't know. And we end with Moby playing. But that was my one question. Like,
yeah,
this whole episode was about Scully and her journey, but Mulder has the Buddha. Oh, it works, I guess.
And this is just sort of funny, but I noticed, like, Scully, you know, she has her feet up on the coffee table. Like, oh, God, she's got pantyhose on. She's going to fall asleep in pantyhose. How uncomfortable. That sounds terrible.
I had the same thought. Like, you're with a friend. Just take them off.
You can take them off. You have a skirt. Your skirt is long, too. Like,
you're not working. God.
No.
I'm with you.
Ugly. I mean, I'm sure they're, like, required by the FBI in the office.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
And then, like, the joke about David Crosby's baby.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing, like, why David Crosby in particular? The only thing I know about David Crosby is he's the Crosby and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Like, that is all I know. But also, I feel like this is, again, like, in The Unnatural, Mulder makes a joke about Scully's biological clock. And here he says, like, having David Crosby's baby. And it's like, knowing what they know.
Yeah.
You know, like, these are weird jokes. Like, I don't know. Like, those always, like, sort of, like, jar me out of it for a second, because it seems like something they wouldn't joke about.
It's odd.
It's odd. Weird.
Especially after the whole Emily situation, and she wasn't able to adopt. That's the X-Files for you. I don't know.
Yes, it is. Oh, speaking of Emily, one last thing on Christmas Carol and Emily, there's a flashback of Dana Scully and Melissa Scully talking about, you know, Scully choosing the FBI, like choosing this path or this path, mm-hmm. and Melissa saying, you know, don't confuse the path for what's really important, which is the people, you know, the people you're going to meet along the way. So I feel like it sort of calls back to that of Scully being content, like she's here, just here with Mulder, and this is where she's supposed to be, and that, I don't know, it calls back to that for me.
That's a great catch. I didn't think about that one. I like how you've tied it all back to Melissa.
Yeah, I was thinking about Melissa a lot watching this lately.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about Milagro and Monday. So that's interesting how we both got different either callbacks or saw different things in the episode. But I really like all of the Melissa connections that you've made. So I guess with that, let's go to the mailbag. So, I'm not going to get this name right. I'm so sorry in advance. Renee La Riviere said that it was a solid episode. The monologue at the beginning is great, which we agreed with. The acting is great. The directing is great. The music is annoying. It has produced some wonderful fan fiction. That's true. It has.
Yeah. I feel like the music is going to be a divisive point. Like it's going to be, it's like cilantro. It's like you love it or you hate it.
Moby is like cilantro.
This is also how I describe Milagro. It's like, it's like cilantro.
Yeah, I guess that could be true. I could see that. Christian Ponce says, good episode, perhaps a little unfocused. I find it interesting how Jillian was able to introduce several of her own concerns about Buddhism, sexuality, etc. It is not a perfect one. A bit too solemn and capricious at moments, but still interesting. I agree with that. That's
fair.
Fairly solid. Yeah, I agree. Tony Black says, underrated for my money, brave in the sense it plays down and even mocks traditional paranormality and exchanges it for new age introspection and religion, but it is a great means of exploring aspects of Scully that have existed since the beginning. Not just her battle to believe, but the Freudian attraction she has to strong-willed father figures, which we definitely discussed. Mulder barely appears, but this is very much part of Season 7's settled roadmap toward their platonic love blooming into the sexual, hence the ambiguity of the opening sequence. And had Scully not had this experience and reunion with Daniel Waterston, I'm not sure she would have taken the next step with Mulder. It's quite key on a character level, and no Carter or Spotnitz or any male writer / director could have told this story in the way Jillian does. Thank you. Even when it straddles the pretentious, I think it's a fine piece of work. What do you think? Pretentious?
I've never thought of it that way. I understand why somebody might think of it that way. Like, might think that it was maybe a little too much, like, pushing certain ideas about
Yeah, I really like what Tony says about this interaction with Waterston, like sort of solidifying Scully's resolve, taking the next step with Mulder, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I think I totally agree with that. I think it's a good point. And we should probably point out that Tony has written a couple of really great pieces on the Mulder-Scully relationship and how it evolved over the seasons. And if anybody hasn't read those yet, you should definitely read those. I think he has one for season 6, 7, and 8, or at least 6 and 7.
I forget the exact seasons, but yes, something like that on 25 YL Media, 25 years later. Adam Silva says, it's not terrible, but it's clear Jillian is using the show to explore and represent some of her interests, whether they fit or not. Even for a series as elastic as it is, it stretches almost to the limit of what is still an X-Files story. If it wasn't for the suggestion that this was when Mulder and Scully may have consummated their relationship, I'm not sure it could be justified. But it's interesting at times and well done. I don't think Jillian was shy at all about saying that this was a way for her to explore her own spirituality.
Yeah, I think she pretty much just said, I wrote this for me.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote this for me. And also for, like, because she had, like, sort of embodied Scully for all this time and sort of had something to say about Scully. And, yeah, and I think that, like, what Adam is saying, I think that's, like, one of the most common criticisms is that it's Jillian pushing this, like, certain philosophy. Which, like, I mean, I guess I sort of understand it, but I never, like, interpret the episode that way. I interpret the episode as, like, that's something that's in there. That's something she wants in there. But it's not, but to me, that's not what it's about. Like, it's about Scully and her emotional journey. And yeah. It's sort of like Tony said of, like, you know, solidifying her resolve to that this is her life's work, that you know, with Mulder is where she's supposed to be, that sort of thing.
This one's a really long one. I'm not sure I'll read the whole thing, but I'll definitely read some of it. Andrew Levitt says that All Things is one of the few instances this season where something different works for the show's favor. Not since Never Again have we had such a deep exploration of Scully's character. And it's very well written, but quite long. And if anyone wants to go onto the basement and read the rest of it, it's very complimentary of the episode. It does say, I'll admit, All Things was not an episode I appreciated until I had rewatched it several times and the deeper aspects of the episode began to sink in. So yeah, I can see that. There's a lot going on here. A lot about feminism on the X-Files and spirituality and how that fits into the greater context of the show. So yeah, I absolutely agree.
And I like how, like, you and I, and also this person's comment who we just read, like, sort of called it back to Never Again as far as, like, the exploration of Scully's emotional journey. I wasn't sure if that was just me.
Building on the base of previous writers? Oh, yeah, no, I definitely see that. It really feels like she borrowed a lot from that, which, I mean, it makes sense. It's her character, so I'm sure a lot of that is, I don't know if ingrained, but she knows this character better than anyone at this point.
Right. Yeah, and it sort of, like, makes all these puzzle pieces fit because she's pulling from these older episodes.
Yeah. I think I'll end it there. So where can we find you online, Dina?
Well, I've been a little absent from the basement group lately, but I'm hoping to be back in there commenting about, like, the rest of season 7 pretty soon. As those come up, those mailbags come up. So there, and also I am on Twitter at DNutButter, which is peanut butter, all one word, with a D instead of a P, where mostly if I do tweet, it's about the X-Files or science or food. So if you're into that.
And I am on Twitter at Annie X Flowers, and I don't really use Facebook that much anymore, so I'm not really in the basement anymore, but definitely on Twitter, not starting Twitter wars about All Things. Dina, thank you so much for joining me. It was so good to see you, or chat with you, I suppose.
Oh, thanks, Annie. This was fun.
You can find us on Twitter at @TheX_cast and on our Facebook group, The X-Files Basement, The X-Cast Podcast Fan Group. And remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Podcast 616, a Marvel Universe podcast.
I definitely noticed that they weren't the actual voice actors. It didn't bother me. It didn't feel strange or anything. I mean, we as viewers have become so accustomed to seeing, you know, Chris Pratt as Star-Lord, or Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa, or Dave Bautista as Drax, that in these instances, when we hear their voices and they don't necessarily match, it's like, oh, wait a second, man, that's not the right person. But, you know, stepping outside of it for a moment, you know, these are comic book characters. We're introducing the multiverse, right? And now we are introducing all of these tangents of stories that can go in any different kind of direction. So they don't need to be the same actor. They don't need to be the same voice one-to-one, in my mind. And as a fan, I can accept this. I'm okay with that.
The Movie Palace Podcast.
Yeah, is Truffaut somebody you found yourself drawn to over the years? Have you watched, like, a lot of his films?
So, just in terms of, like, French New Wave, I think I've seen more Jean-Luc Godard than I've seen François Truffaut. But I really do love François Truffaut. I love his attention to realism and to small aspects of people's lives. And I love his stories and how character-driven they are. I've seen, like, Shoot the Piano Player, Jules and Jim, which isn't one of my favorites, but I'm trying to appreciate it more.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Craig Charles looks cool as Sebastian Doyle. Yeah. I'd love to look that cool. Oh, bad.
Craig Charles tends to look cool all of the time, though.
Well, true, but he looks more sophisticated cool than Rocker Dude with a band cool. And I'm getting old, I want to look sophisticated cool rather than Rocker Dude cool.
Craig Charles had apparently said that, you know, it's it was great to be able to play this version of Lister because that's more like me. Or is he being the cool guy? which I thought was great.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @TheX_cast, on Facebook by typing in The X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, The X-Cast Podcast Fan Group, and on Instagram at The X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/TheXCast. That's patreon.com/TheXCast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter @WeMadeThisPod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.